Good morning, everyone. The Senate E-12 Budget Division will come to order. Today is Tuesday, January 20, 2015. Today we're going to talk about technology, and as it states on the screen in front of us, it's a conduit to opportunity. We're going to hear from many experts, a statewide perspective, a local school district perspective. I'm really excited about the next couple of hours. I want to thank many of the persons involved in putting this together in terms of the speakers, particularly the Minnesota School Boards Association, and Denise Dietrich, who has been so enthusiastic taking the message from the Delegate Assembly. And these are resolutions that come from school districts, and we're going to hear a great deal about the importance of technology, the needs for us to do more, the opportunity that's ahead. We do have on the agenda later a few Senate files that will address some funding possibilities. We will have a brief introduction on those, and then, like many of the proposals, lay them on the table for possible inclusion as we get more information about our budget targets in the future. So, members, we're going to start first with Senator Matt Schmidt, who's been working on the issue just on broadband in general, high-speed internet, and he will have a proposal that will be referred to the committee later. We're not going to have a hearing on that right now, but recognizing the involvement that you've been doing, we appreciate your taking time to join us, Senator Schmidt.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, and thank you for including the M in my last name. It wasn't long ago I was on live radio, and that was omitted. So talk about an embarrassing moment. And in the classroom, it's happened a few times in life, so thank you. Just wanted to thank you for the opportunity to talk about technology in broadband. It's an issue that we've spent a lot of time on in Minnesota the last few years. We've had three different governor's task forces on broadband. A lot of great activity, philanthropic in particular, around the state, leading the charge, Blandon Foundation, and also communities, just taking the issue up themselves, trying to learn more and push the dial as much as they can to invest in technology and be competitive in this realm. So as a freshman legislator, I got a little bored, I guess, last year, and I decided to go visit some communities around the state in the depth of the winter. And we had two different tours. We just talked to communities that have been discussing this issue in the past. One of them started, I think, on the coldest day of the year, actually. I think it was January. The governor had canceled school around the state, and we had about 50 people show up in Park Rapids in the early morning to talk about the importance of internet connectivity. And that told the story of, if nothing else, that this is important in the lives of so many Minnesotans. And what I like to focus on is the end user experience. We have state speed goals in place. We have, I think, made great progress in the last decade. But we're actually falling a little behind relative to other states in this area. And so what I focus on is the end user experience, not necessarily numbers, but what we're doing, what we're getting out of this connectivity that matters so much. It can be telehealth applications. It can be e-commerce, starting businesses at home. It can be the opportunity to engage in distance learning. And what we see in education K-12, in particular, flip schedules, students being able to take devices home and expand that learning environment beyond the 4, 5, 6 period day, to the evenings when they can listen to lectures, come to school the next day and be ready to engage in discussion with their teachers. And so what I think is so important in this realm is that it's not just about having connectivity in our classrooms. A lot of schools in Minnesota are doing pretty darn well. They're not all there. But what we have to ensure is that when kids have those devices, they're able to take them home and access the internet and be able to continue that learning day when they leave the school. One story that I heard that really, you know, was I guess, disappointing, if nothing else, is the fact that a student had to take a standardized test outside a library with a hotspot in the depth of winter, sitting in his car. And I just think that's inexcusable in Minnesota for us to be relying upon hotspots in public libraries for education. And so another important, I guess, anecdote I wanted to share with you today is on our tour, when we visited about 20 communities last year, over 500 individuals showed up. We heard one thing predominantly after time. It used to be that when a family was looking to move to a community, the first question they asked is, how good are the schools? We'd all agree that's an important question to ask. Increasingly today, though, the first question that families ask is, what's the broadband connectivity like? Are we able to create a business from home? Are our students able to learn from our homes? And I think that's an important question for this committee to take with it as we continue to talk about technology in the classroom. So there's so much more that can be said about this issue, but I look at your agenda and I see incredible testimony before us here. So I'm going to end my remarks here. I think we have a couple of bills that I'd like to bring back to this committee down the road here this session. And I just really applaud the committee for taking the time to talk about technology, because it's so important in connecting our state and our students to opportunities down the road.
Thank you very much, Senator Schmidt. We'll look forward to your testimony formally on the bills that are in process. And you mentioned the importance of technology for cities, a part of the infrastructure. I wanted to mention the League of Cities, and their most recent publication did an excellent job of underscoring that importance as well. So it's a effort by many different groups, and we'll look forward to working together to make additional progress that's needed.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks. Next, we're going to have, from the Minnesota School Boards Association, Denise Dietrich and Gary Amoroso from the Association of School Administrators. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. As was mentioned, my name is Denise Dietrich, and I'm with the Minnesota School Boards Association. As you look at the agenda for today, as you can see, it's extremely full. But I thought it was really important that I just provide a little bit of context as to how and why this group came together over this topic. The Minnesota School Boards Association began working with the Minnesota High Tech Association and the Minnesota School Administrators about 3 months ago, where we started a discussion on technology, where we are and where we are going, and we coined it the state of school technology. Throughout these discussions, we thought it was important to identify a theme, so we landed on a theme that we thought encompassed our discussions, and it is technology is the conduit to opportunity. I thought that was pretty clever for a bunch of IT folks. But because of their influence on them, on me, I thought it was really important that I define the word conduit. So I first of all went to Webster's Dictionary, I have to admit, and then I thought, now, Denise, allow these guys to have a little influence on you. So I went to dictionary.com. That's a big thing for me, really. So according to dictionary.com, conduit is a natural or artificial channel through which something is conveyed. Synonyms, pipe or tube. This became actually the perfect theme for what we want to talk about today, because what it really became clear to me through the discussions with our experts in the room is that technology is the means. It is not the end by which students learn. But today with the people in this room and their expertise, we're going to demonstrate some of the ways that technology is the conduit to effective learning in our schools. But I really want to make note that these experiences are available for some students in some parts of the state. They are not uniform, as our Minnesota Constitution envisions our public education system. In Minnesota, there is a digital gap, and the range of the digital opportunities depend on the funding that their school districts receive. And without equity and technology innovation in our schools, I believe we are marginalizing some students who will not be prepared for the 21st century workforce. Today, we hope to inspire you to address equity in funding for technology by demonstrating some of the great things that are going on in our classrooms. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Amoroso.
Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gary Amoroso. I serve as Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. And we're very thankful that we're being provided this opportunity today to talk about this very, very important topic. We, as Ms. Dietrich said, have been working with our colleagues at MSBA to look at the area of technology and thoroughly understand that technology is no longer an option. It's not something that is something that can be used from time to time. Technology is how we learn. Technology is how we teach. It's how we thrive in our society. And right now we have a situation where your zip code helps to determine if you have access in a way that others may or may not have. So we're here today to tell a story. We're very excited that we have four members of our association who serve as technology leaders from across the state. and they are going to share with you what is currently happening in Minnesota and what some of our challenges are. So with that, it's my honor, Mr. Chair and committee members, to introduce Josh Swanson, who is the Assistant Superintendent for the Edina Eden Prairie, excuse me, I'm sorry, Prairie School District. Thank you.
I remember that. Good morning.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to be here. My name is Josh Swanson, Assistant Superintendent of Eden Prairie Schools. Along with being an educator for well over 20 years, I'm also one of those IT people. I'd like to start with just a story today. An interesting thing happened around 1993. The National Center for Supercomputing Applications created a product called Mosaic. It was capable of taking data that had been moving across a mostly unused internet and displaying it in a way that was better than just words. It had graphics and eventually the ability to integrate sound and video. It was the birth of what we called the internet. Then the whole world changed as we know it. Well, most of it anyway. Since the advent of what we view as the modern internet, nearly every segment of industry has had to reinvent themselves. The internet has been the most significant driver of our economy and has become deeply embedded in our personal lives. It has changed how we connect and work with others. Schools, for the most part, have adapted slowly to change. Books have been written about why this is, but a large part of the issue is one of adequate resources. While many of us remember a world without internet, the students we see today do not know a world without it. In fact, we're quickly approaching a timeline where parents with school-aged children have never known what it was like to look in a phone book, consult an encyclopedia, or call a library to ask for some specific information. In an ideal world, schools would be trying to prepare students for a trajectory that propels them into post-secondary life, prepared to not just survive in that new world, but to thrive. We want them to continue to push change, innovation, and to lead. In an ideal system, we would be ahead of where the world is heading. In most Minnesota school districts, we are behind and running at a constant pace, while the world is running faster with each lap. We would like to spend our time with you today describing the state of Minnesota schools and technology, and to hopefully help you understand why we have both a passion and an urgency for this conversation. We will describe why Minnesota's workforce will need fluidity in the use of technology to not only work with information, but to engage others in problem solving and to innovate. We see technology as a conduit to opportunity, a means of giving all Minnesota students a better chance of success in college, career, and in life. Our vision is for every student in Minnesota to be a digital learner. To date, Minnesota's funding model has treated technology as an option. It is not. This creates an opportunity gap for our students, and as long as that exists, we will not be able to truly become an example of educational excellence. We believe that technology is that conduit to opportunity. The technology creates authentic and meaningful learning opportunities. The technology helps us build a highly effective and competent workforce. We believe that through building that conduit to opportunities, we will eliminate disparities and opportunity gaps that exist because of a zip code. And that technology is critical to ensure each of our children develops the 21st century skills and global competencies to be successful as they leave our public education system. We believe that as a state, we have the opportunity to be a model of educational excellence for others across the country, and that we can transform education for each child in the classroom. We believe that how we go about doing this is through ensuring our children and schools have connectivity and access, that our schools embrace digital learning, that they leverage data systems, and that appropriate resources are available for professional development and support. Today, members of our team will describe how, as a state, we could go about creating a technology conduit and what that would look like. We believe that we need to invest in educational excellence and invest in technology to strategically position our state and our children for their future. Today, we will be speaking about each of the four areas that I've outlined that are currently on the screen. I would like to now introduce Margaret Anderson Keller, who is the President and CEO of Minnesota High Tech Association and the Chair of the Governor's Broadband Task Force, to speak about connectivity, which is a foundational first step. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Welcome, Ms. Sanderson Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, and thank you for taking the time to focus on the issues of technology, as well as we appreciate the work that's been happening in coalition with the other groups. I'm going to speak to you today both as chair of the Governor's Broadband Task Force, as well as president and CEO of the Minnesota High Tech Association. I'm going to break my comments into those two sections and speak first about connectivity across the state of Minnesota. So first, a little bit of overview of the Governor's Broadband Task Force. As Senator Schmidt said, the Governor's Broadband Task Force brings together a number of different types of interests across the state. We've been in existence for almost 4 years now, and we bring together consumers, groups like the Blandon Foundation, community groups, education and healthcare institutions, traditional telephone and cable companies, wireless providers, as well as metro and rural local governmental units. And we have a goal, and that goal is to help make a recommendation to the governor, and we believe to all of you as well, a plan to help Minnesotans get border-to-border broadband service at the state's speed goals. And the state speed goals, just to refresh your memory, are in state statute as 10 megabits of download and 5 megabits of upload. Now, you have a map in your packet, as well as it's on the screen, and there are interactive maps available on the DEED website at the Office of Broadband that you can get more detail on. This is a little bit of a surprising map to folks because it is not just a one story across the state about where the access is. And it's an important map in that it really shows a way that broadband helps expand economic access and educational opportunities to all Minnesotans across the state. In the last 4 years, with your help, Minnesotans have made significant progress in reaching these statutory goals. We have been able to see some significant investment, but there's more to be done. To reach every Minnesotan with this speed goal, the last and most recent estimate we have, so at the most basic technology would be $900 million. At the high-speed technology of something like fiber to the home would be $3.2 billion to reach every Minnesotan. We don't expect that the public would do all of that, but in partnership, we know public and private, we can do that together. As of October 2014, 78.16% of Minnesota households have access to broadband access at that speed goal, and that's wired. That means coming through the ground. That does not mean including the cellular service. And we do that for a very specific reason, and that is the economics of being able to afford the wired service is much more economical. We do measure the wireless service as well. This means that 37% largely rural households do not have or remain underserved in respect to the state broadband speed goals. And we would say that's far too many. This inequality, especially in rural areas, makes it particularly challenging for our schools, as you can imagine, with the technology needs to educate children in the 21st century skill set that we expect them to have. If Minnesota households, especially in rural areas of the state, do not have access to broadband, then schools are likely to have less adequate connection as well, or maybe no connection, or a subpar connection. The Broadband Task Force is working with the Office of Broadband Development to gather the information on connection to K-12 schools throughout the state right now. The information is necessary for you and for us to be able to make the recommendations and decisions that are going to be necessary. We do recommend that the state make a coordinated effort to assemble the data for the decision-making, and that the demand for broadband is only going to increase over time for businesses, schools, and families. As you will hear today, technology is already playing an increasingly important role in our schools. As you have already heard about and you're going to hear more about today, that the one-to-one device movement, where students are maybe having a tablet of some type and being able to work on it, if they have that tablet in school and then they have a homework assignment to take home, and they are not connected and able to adequately be able to do that homework at home, that is really a disadvantage for that student. That is really something that we see as a problem in the way things are designed today. Even without that one-to-one device initiative, the lack of access to broadband hinders students' ability to learn. It's the assignment of homework that requires the use of the internet for research at home. Communication between parents and teachers that is going on. The submitting of class assignments, which is fairly common now today, to upload your assignments into some sort of Dropbox-like device. The paying of school fees, even the lunch fee that needs to happen. The individual student comfort when it comes to taking standardized tests online or accommodations for tests. The story that Senator Schmidt told is a story that's repeated, especially when it comes to national tests across the state of Minnesota. The need for proctored tests outside of school hours and the need that libraries play in being able to deliver that proctored test service even outside the library's regular hours with the use of the library Wi-Fi. So this is something that we see. In addition to the issue of broadband availability, we know that there are population groups in Minnesota that do not adopt broadband as readily as other population groups, and we're working on that as well. Low-income households adopt broadband at a rate 20% below the state average, and rural households adopt broadband at a rate of 6% lower than the rest of the state average. We need to make sure we're also paying attention to cost. Just going to give you a little bit of a comparison. In South Central Minnesota, internet access can be obtained for as little as $1 per megabit a month. In Southwest and West Central Minnesota, the average internet per megabit cost is $9.72 per megabit. In East Central Minnesota, the cost is $5. And in Northeast Minnesota, the cost can be as high as $11.67. So you can see that there's a wide range here as well. We also believe that E-rate reimbursements and Minnesota Telecommunications Equity Aid can help equalize this for schools and libraries. But there's gaps that exist, and the costs continue to rise, and this is something that is really important as bandwidth and the use of bandwidth continues to increase. Fiber leases look like this across the state. The state average is $23.46 per megabit a month. And in East Central, that's in the southwest part of the state. In East Central Minnesota, they actually have much more economical fiber leases at $2.32. So you can see the range. So you heard from Senator Schmidt, and I just want to reiterate, he has been a great champion of these issues. We also know that there are implications in the workforce for these issues, and I'm going to just switch to give you a little bit of a perspective on that. The disparity in schools has an impact on workforce readiness and availability. And so I have a few things in your packet I would like to point out today to you. So first of all is an infographic we've prepared for you that has come from Connect Minnesota 2014 Business Survey Results. And this is a nice infographic that details some of the things that connect to Minnesota, which was one of our on-the-ground measurement entities, found about business connectivity. And then the other thing that I'd like to talk about is the skills gap. And this is something that one of our up-and-coming leadership groups found last year, adoption of computer science standards, how Minnesota compares. And I will just prepare you. You are going to be shocked. This graph is from some research that has been done about adoption of the skills that students need and the impact that we can extrapolate that it has on the workforce of the future. So just to put in context, in Minnesota, by 2020, in the STEM field, science, technology, engineering, and math, Minnesota will need up to 180,000 workers in the STEM fields. This is from the Georgetown Ready to Work study that was done a few years ago. This means that we will need more people who have 2- and 4-year and certificate degrees in these areas. Companies like 3M, Ecolab, Boston Scientific, Thomson Reuters understand that more work needs to be done to support not only those students in the post-secondary arena, but also students in the K-12 arena, so they are more prepared to enter these areas. They also know that you cannot just place your solutions in one place. They understand that you need to take a variety of approaches. And I think that's where this little graph, and we can get you the detail on this, and you do have the link on it. This measures student readiness at all levels, starting in the earliest grades all the way through to high school. And what's a little shocking here is if you look at the left of this, Iowa is fairly far up. I know no one likes to be beat by Iowa in this room. And what we found is that Iowa has taken some of their project lead the way focus and not only focused on engineering, but they also focused specifically on computer science. And so what they've done is they've embedded in their curriculum more computer science in their early grades and their later grades. And this is something that I think is important to think about. This is not saying everybody has to be a computer science major. It's being able to show proficiency going forward. We know these skills are critical. We know that things like IT certifications can be a pathway to doing this. In fact, last year, you as a legislature passed some permissive legislation for a possibility of an IT academy at the high school level that I think is in the Minnesota Department of Education still, and so that's maybe something to follow up on. It's a program that exists in 19 other states, and we think these are important things. In North Carolina,
Jensen sponsored that, and we are awaiting an update. So
perfect.
Thank you.
In North Carolina, after the state made a commitment to a program like this with an IT academy that high schoolers took, they quickly achieved a milestone of over 100,000 students receiving a Microsoft certification. And there are a couple companies that would compete for this, but Microsoft is one of them. Those student achievements are coming from small, large, rural, and urban schools. So we think this is important. Now, this is focusing on what can happen. Part of this is about connection and the availability of connection for all students. The secondary piece of this is about how prepared we are for the future and how our workforce is going to measure up. And I can tell you this, leading the association I lead, the number one thing that people say to us time after time today in this economy is not about resources or about capital. Those are important issues, but they say the number one thing that stops their growth in Minnesota today is talent and availability of talent in the science and technology area. So we have to stay focused on this. So I'd like to introduce to you someone who has been working on this issue and with something very exciting. something that we've been partnering on. And to illustrate a focus on this for the part after high school, and that is Mark Hurlbert from Prime Digital Academy. So I'm going to welcome Mark up to the table. Thank you for your time today.
And Ms. Keller Anderson, we will be taking questions later, but Sandra Bonoff, who also has another committee, she's going to ask one right
okay.
now.
Okay, thanks.
We'll open up.
Thank
yes.
you, Mr. Chair. I continue to see Massachusetts always at the top.
Yes.
Do you have any insight as to why they're so nimble? What are they doing that always, you know, has them be in the top in terms of outcomes?
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, I think there's a few things that we can learn from Massachusetts. And we do have some things that we've kind of gone back and forth with Massachusetts over the years on things like being the brain power state and focus on that. Their concentration of higher education obviously is maybe a little more than ours. They have more colleges per capita in their state than I think any other state in the country. And so obviously they have an emphasis on higher education in a way that's very interesting. They also have had a focus on a number of different types of standards. They've been very much I'm not saying standards yes, standards no, and I don't even, others would be much more appropriate to talk about what types of standards Massachusetts has. But they have for a long time been a state that has been focused on having standards around the STEM area. And so I think being focused on that has helped them as well. Really push their students forward. And then just the concentration of these STEM jobs. We're always looking at Massachusetts as one of our states that we look to compete with when it comes to the STEM jobs. Obviously, we have a debate about concentration of medical device jobs with Massachusetts. They are a little higher on the biotech side of things. We're higher on the pure med device side of things. So both of those things together kind of push us. But I think when it comes strictly to information technology as an enabling backbone competency, we could do better there to help ourselves be ready for the next wave.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hurlbert. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much for the introduction, Margaret. So my name is Mark Hurlbert. As Margaret mentioned, I am the president of a new organization called Prime Digital Academy that has been launched in partnership with The Nerdery, which is a software development company in Bloomington with 500 developers that I had the pleasure of serving on the executive team at for about 10 years. So my task here today is to talk to you guys a little bit about 21st century workforce skills. The impetus behind our school is very much based on what we had found historically at the Nerdery, and what we found in the over 36 partners that are signed up to hire employees coming out of our school at Prime Digital, which is very much echoing what Margaret had mentioned, which is just saying that there aren't enough talented workers that are ready for what the workforce is looking for in terms of high-tech jobs, specifically development and application development jobs here in Minnesota. And I guess I have a few questions here that I'm asked to speak on, and I'll try and hit through these at a high level. The first is, while there is a high level of consensus around the fact that there is a talent gap that is limiting expansion in some business areas, I think there is not as much consensus around what exactly that is and what role schools and other organizations can play in filling that. So I can kind of give you our perspective on it, which is that really, amazingly, we've been talking to Over the last several months, as we've been developing our curriculum, I've had several dozen meetings with companies speaking to their engineering staff, their recruiting staff, their human resources staff about what it is that's preventing them from being able to find the right people to fill the jobs that are necessary. And surprisingly, even speaking to the engineers, and you know, these are kind of the brass tacks, the people who belong at a place called the Nerdery. these people emphasize not necessarily the technical skills. I think the technical skills are really important and in some ways are a given. But one of the things that's really holding people back is what would more commonly be considered the soft skills, the behavioral skills, the communication skills, the collaboration skills. Those have become increasingly important and are something that often people are coming into the workforce without a strong background in, a strong strong practice area in, and that's definitely become a challenge for employers to be able to bring them together and be able to make those people kind of workforce ready from the very beginning. One of the challenges that I think a lot of traditional education focuses on is they focus on trying to load people with those technical skills. And, you know, I can tell you right now, the average time in the United States to finish a BA degree, people take on average 6 years. So the class of 2015 in computer science, when they began their studies, the iPads, which everybody's taking notes on around the room, those didn't exist yet. Mobile traffic, which accounts right now for about 30% of traffic on the internet, was just under 1% of the traffic. So the speed with which things are happening in technology really makes it kind of folly to try and give people the specific technical skills that they're going to use in a job, you know, their freshman year in high school. I think that a lot of what needs to be considered is how can we build a framework? How can we build the tool set and the mindset in students for continuous learning that's going to serve them beyond kind of the tactics of whatever is popular at any given time? What we really look for in candidates and what the Nerdery and our other partners look for employees is people who are resilient, who can continue to keep pace with change as it moves forward and be able to adapt. Ultimately, we're not seeing people enter the workforce with those skills, unfortunately. And we're really seeing, in many cases, kind of two different camps of people that aren't quite ready. We're seeing people who have a good abstract understanding of the technology, but they don't necessarily have the ability to bring that tactically into practice. And we're also seeing people on the flip side where they have a lot of tactical skills, but they don't necessarily have the abstract knowledge of how to bring it together. The last thing that I was asked to address is the importance of technology in the classroom. And I doubt there's anybody in this room that would stand up and say, you know, technology in the classroom is not that important. It definitely is critical and very, very important for our students at all age levels to be fluent in technology, to have the ability to be able to work in the modern context that we're providing. I think one of the things that I would like to stress and that I would like legislators like yourselves to be thinking about is that technology in the classroom is not a panacea. Just putting iPads, putting a broadband, putting laptops into the classroom isn't the answer any more than putting furniture into the classroom is the answer. I think that putting technologists in the classroom alongside that technology is critically important. And that's one of the things that we really see a challenge in the education industry is that often the people who are being asked to teach the students about technology don't have access to adequate training themselves to be able to provide that information. And industry in general has failed to engage at education in just about all levels to be able to bring their insights and their expertise and their needs into the classroom in a way that it can be reflected by the evolution and kind of the changes within those educational systems. The only other item that I'd like to bring up and to be thinking about in the concept of STEM education specifically is the importance of trying to build a diverse set of candidates coming out of the school system that are excited about STEM. Some of our partners have taken the initiative on themselves to develop scholarship opportunities for women who are studying at Prime. And I think that it's critically important that both women and underrepresented minorities in technology are supported in their learning environment, both you know, early on in school and then later on in post-secondary education. So I guess that's the summation of my remarks. I'm happy to take any questions if you guys have any.
We're going to take questions following testimony from the others, but it's very, very helpful. Thank
Excellent.
You.
Thank you.
Mark Johnson.
See if I can do this without disconnecting something important.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you this morning. I'm Mark Johnson, Executive Director of the East Central Minnesota Educational Cable Cooperative. We call it ECMEC, just so you can say it in one syllable or two. I represent a technology cooperative owned by 14 member districts in mostly rural East Central Minnesota. And for almost 32 years, our mission has been to provide opportunities for kids through technology. Now, you just heard about the needs for workforce and 21st century skills like communication, collaboration, and critical thinking. In education, however, we don't want to forget about the need to address our state standards. So we're going to take a look moving forward at how we're weaving those together to provide opportunities for students through technology in our schools. First of all, if you look at that picture, some of you remember the textbooks and so on that you used when you were in school. You had history texts that talked about events from a decade ago as current. We had heavy, bulky, and expensive science texts, math textbooks that were aligned to Texas and California standards. You know, if you think back at your experience in a classroom, you may have been asked to read some of those texts at home. And then when you get to class, you may have heard a lecture and taken some notes. You're probably sent home with problems to complete and more reading. And if you had questions, you hoped that your parents would be able to answer them. Classrooms look differently today, with interactive whiteboards, collaborative projects, and computers and mobile devices now commonplace. But we still have issues with expensive textbooks that can be outdated before they put them in students' hands. They lack engaging content, and they're not consistent with Minnesota academic standards. About 3 years ago, some state educators started to look seriously at this problem. They recognized a need for high-quality digital curriculum that was already aligned to Minnesota's academic standards and that was flexible, allowing teachers to add and subtract content to meet their students' needs. They saw the potential for personal learning devices like laptops and tablets to change the way teachers teach and the way students learn, bringing 21st century skill development to students anytime, anywhere. We believed that the best way to address these needs was to model these skills and collaborate with educators, curriculum specialists, administrators, content specialists, and more to create digital curriculum for Minnesota's schools. Places like Anoka-Hennepin, ECMEC, Intermediate District 287, and others were already involved at the time at creating some of these digital resources. We started talking together about doing this on a larger scale, and thus was born the Minnesota Partnership for Collaborative Curriculum, which today involves 185 Minnesota school districts working together to create digital curriculum for grades 3 through 12 in the core content areas of math, science, social studies, and English language arts. The curriculum is designed to be laser-focused on Minnesota's academic standards and work with computers, iPads, and other tablet devices. It facilitates personalized learning and integrates 21st century skills. It is also printable and adaptable by local teachers to meet the needs of all students. I believe you have a one-page summary of the Minnesota Partnership in your handout or your packet. If you don't, we'll make sure that you get that. This video, and we'll see if the sound works and everything, shows a sixth-grade student describing how the partnership materials are being used in place of a traditional textbook in his sixth-grade math class at a school in East Central Minnesota.
Classroom, which is you do the studying at home and then the work at school. It's now what everybody calls it, schoolwork instead of homework. And what he does is he has a YouTube channel, and he does videos on him teaching lessons, and then he sends us those videos via email. And we get them, and then we have to, our homework technically is to watch them. And then when we get to school the next day, we do the schoolwork on a website called Flexbook.
Okay.
And We have it bookmarked, so it's like an app. You just go into it and use that. And so when we get to school the next day, we go into the chapter we're learning and do the work that he has put out for us, whatever it is we were learning.
And here you can actually see a student watching one of the videos. That student didn't show you to it, but he did a good job of describing the kind of learning that they're doing. And in class, then, they're able to collaborate with their peers. They're able to have more access to the teacher for getting their questions answered and for going through the work. So it's a little bit of a different kind of learning. And that's one way that some of the partnership materials are being used. We have another example. Sorry about this. Let's see if I can get this to work. Nope, I can't. Okay, I'll describe it.
If there's ever a place where it's going to work.
You know, exactly. Yeah, and here we go. But Plan B, we always have one of those. But, of course, if Plan B was good as Plan A, we wouldn't need Plan A. But the English Language Arts Partnership for Collaborative Curriculum lesson that I was going to show integrates the critical thinking skills, the collaboration skills, those 21st century digital learning skills. They have the students watch a video about it. It's a myth. It happens to be a lesson about myths. They have them watch a video about it. They have them get into groups of 2 to 4 students and collaborate on an assignment and a critical thinking assignment based upon the video that they saw. They create written and digital materials, and then in essence what they do at the end of the lesson is they load those materials into a digital portfolio. So it's another example. I'm sorry we couldn't show it to you, but it's another example of how the Partnership for Collaborative Curriculum materials are being used in classrooms around the state of Minnesota. We do have challenges with this type of digital curriculum. Students need high-speed broadband access away from school or at home, and you've heard about that. Senator Schmidt and others talked about it. In order to view these media-rich lessons, the cost of providing computers or mobile devices is prohibitive for many districts, especially those with smaller enrollments. These issues cause a disparity that often requires accommodations to be made for providing content to the students before they go home and things like that. And it really starts to diminish the effectiveness of using this type of learning in classrooms when they don't have that kind of access or when they don't have the equipment that they need. On your handout and up on the screen, there's a couple of links, again, where you can go to find out more about the Partnership for Collaborative Curriculum that is creating these digital resources for our students. Changing gears just a little bit, we talk about technology as a conduit to opportunity. In rural Minnesota, students often do not have the same opportunities to connect with people and places that expose students to the world around them. With rising transportation costs and increasing demands on classroom learning time, students are participating in fewer experiences away from the classroom, like visits to science, history and art museums, concerts, and other cultural activities. They simply can't be away from the classroom for an entire day. Each year, though, hundreds of interactive video presentations from world-class museums, professional writers, artists, and musicians are brought directly into classrooms around the state, most frequently in Greater Minnesota schools. For example, students in a medical careers class in East Central Minnesota, pictured up there on the left, were able to view a live donor kidney transplant from start to end. And again, their medical careers class. They interacted with the surgeons or the surgical team. They asked questions, and they learned what the roles of all those involved were. On the right, you can see the Minnesota History Center is bringing history alive through interactive video sessions with elementary and middle school students around the state. The McPhail Center for Music in Minneapolis provides a unique opportunity for music education by bringing their professional musicians to classrooms in Greater Minnesota for individual and large group learning through interactive video. And we have another quick video clip that I think will help you understand the opportunities that interactive video can provide in the classroom. Whoops. There I go again.
Hey, Kana. Kwa imani.
Kwa imani.
Yote yawezekana.
Yote yawezekana.
Kwa imani.
Kwa imani.
That's the whole song.
Yote yawezekana. Kwa imani, yote yawezekana. Kwa imani.
That's what he sees.
Okay? All right, everybody together again. Yote, 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 yote. Here we go. One, two, three.
Yote yawezekana. Kwa imani, yote yawezekana. Kwa imani, yote yawezekana. Kwa imani, yote yawezekana. Kwa imani.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about now.
That's right. The quality of that video and audio is not possible with consumer products like Skype. You need obviously much more than that. One of the challenges is providing these experiences is the cost of the equipment and, again, the bandwidth requirements that you've heard about for fully interactive, high-definition video conferencing like you just saw. Despite the challenges, I believe that all students in every corner of the state need access to this kind of interactive learning that shrinks the world around them. All students need anytime, anywhere access to learning experiences through digital curriculum such as that developed by the Partnership for Collaborative Curriculum. Yeah. Technology truly is our conduit to these opportunities for all students. I'd like now to introduce Dr. Joel Verdine, who will demonstrate use of technology in schools to address specific student populations and career pathways. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll have to make sure Senator Stump sees that clip with Lincoln.
Certainly.
High school. That was great.
Any way we can do that, we will. Yep.
Thank you, Mark. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Joel Verdine, and I'm the Chief Technology Officer from Anoka-Hennepin School District. The focus of the presentation, the part of the presentation that I want to bring to you, talks to specific student experiences, just as Mark had demonstrated, and to talk about them through the lens of technology. So the image up on the screen is one from one of our special needs classrooms. And we have, in Anoka-Hennepin, been providing heavy emphasis on the use of technology within the special needs classrooms because the benefit is both immediate and remarkable in many students' instances. And so in this case, we have students we have a heavy emphasis on the use of technology with students with autism, which is something that many of us in school districts are finding an increased need to respond to the increased numbers of students that we're working with. And in the photo that we're showing here, one of the things that Anoka-Hennepin has done that I'm very proud of is to be very good at monitoring and measuring the impact of some of the initiatives and pilot projects that we've done. And in this particular pilot project, as we looked at some of the results of what we're seeing when we're working with students using this technology is an increase in their communicability with the technology and a marked decrease in negative behaviors, as we find that a lot of times we can engage students with technology more to the point where their frustrations lessen a little bit, and so we have a decrease in some of the negative behaviors that we've been seeing. An interesting thing about technology and assistive needs, we used to spend approximately $12,000 to $15,000 per device for something called a DynaBox. And that was a device that allowed students to better communicate. We have reduced the cost of that into something like a tablet device, such as an iPad, which fits that need plus many, many more. And so one of the interesting things that I find about the special education field is we are now really at the position where we are kind of behind what our parents are experiencing, and our parents drive us to technological solutions, which is not a bad thing. It just is. What it is, but certainly it's an area that we have to be responsive to, and as we talked about technology being optional or not optional, this is an area where neither our parents nor our educators would allow this to be an optional experience for their kids. We find that in this area we have parents who are advocates for their children for the very right reasons, and oftentimes in our response to them, we have to be aware of the different tools available and responsive in how we work with them. And so on that in that front, just in students with special needs, technology has been a huge benefit for us. But it does cost money, and we have to be responsive to that. Students with English learning needs is another area where we've made investments in using technology.
The technology provides immediate feedback to students, can engage students in hearing sounds and words in ways that perhaps teachers can't respond to all the time or with a larger group of students. They're not able to give that type of individual attention, and technology has been an incredible benefit in this area for us in Anoka Hennepin as well. So on the front of working with students with very, very specific needs, technology, I would like to call this sort of a no-brainer. Technology for us is an integral part of that, and it's an area that all schools are working heavily at. Some of the other things that we're doing in Anoka Hennepin is working with what we call career pathways, which are opportunities to provide specialized programming so students can see themselves in a future career more easily. As many of you might know, if you've had children that go through college, sometimes that isn't a straight pathway for them. Many times changing their thoughts and changing their ideas and landing in different places. So we want to give kids experiences that help them see a clear vision of what they may see for themselves in the future. So this is Blaine High School, and Blaine High School, these are four students from Blaine High School's Center for Engineering, Math, and Science. And this photo came after a story that was printed in the Star Tribune about students who created a engineered a solution to a problem that they saw, which is that when you wear shoes, your soles wear out and you throw the shoes away. The rest of the shoe is actually pretty good. And so they thought, well, why wouldn't we have soles on your shoes that you can remove and replace and keep the rest of the shoe? And so this is the picture of the sole that they have developed, which is detachable. It comes off with a zipper. While this may perhaps never be the most marketable idea, what we are proud of is that kids who can engage in kind of creative thinking and problem solving and see that they are actually able to engineer solutions, work with each other, and come up with creative ideas and see those through. Anoka Hennepin, due in part to its size and in part to community support through levies, we have the ability to make some of these programs happen in our high schools. But not all school districts are capable of making a variety of these type programs. And so one of the things that we wanted to emphasize throughout this program is the kinds of things that you've seen, whether it was the examples that Mark brought forward or the examples that I'm talking about, they are very hit or miss in the state of Minnesota, and they're very hit or miss for our students. So some students can do this kind of work, and some students do not have this opportunity as easily, or there are other barriers or challenges to some of these opportunities. The last component that I will demonstrate is a very, very short video about Coon Rapids biomedical program. You heard a little bit earlier the term Project Lead the Way. Project Lead the Way is a somewhat specific curriculum that schools have adopted in the areas of engineering. It actually goes broader than that. It does go into computer science, goes into a whole series of other broader concepts, and biomedical technologies is one of the ones that we've been working with. This is a very short clip describing what we're doing in Coon Rapids. Mark, you're about 0 for...
A new biomedical sciences program is up and running at Coon Rapids High School this year. It's been a long time coming, but there is definitely excitement in the air because of what the curriculum means for the school and the students in District 11. CTN's Jamie Carratt reports.
The phone is off the hook. A syringe is nearby. There's vomit, blood, and a powder substance near Anna Garcia. The scene is set for these Coon Rapids students to essentially become crime scene investigators for the next 22 days.
We have a number of different powders that are going to react differently to some indicators.
This hands-on lab is part of a new biomedical sciences program offered at Coon Rapids High School, and it is the only one of its kind in the North Metro.
And do not tip of the substance.
A lot of these kids are looking for careers of some type in medical. Tools.
160 students signed up to be the first to embark on what the school hopes to be a long and successful journey through the program.
Oh yeah, it's dissolving.
The goal is for students to start as freshmen and finish as seniors, something Madeline Getchell says she plans to do.
I thought it'd be good to like get into colleges and stuff, make me more certain on what I want to do when I'm older.
Coordinator Leah Sam says giving students the ability to earn college credits while streamlining what they want to study in university is both a money saver and a boost for the medical world. The program is also going to teach students valuable life lessons.
This challenges them. It gets them out of the box, and it gets them ready for real life.
One thing you never do when you're testing for substances, you never taste them.
For now, though, these crime scene investigators have a job to do, and that's to determine what was next to Anna Garcia, and she died.
Determined it was aspirin, so we were thinking heart attack, she was taking a low dose of aspirin for it, or something like that.
Program at Coon
Rapids. We like to consider the advice on not tasting the substance one of those things that you would call a life skill. You could find this all across the state of Minnesota, that there are people that are trying to find more ways to make school relevant to students. And in many of these cases, the kinds of programs that we want to put in have additional costs associated with them that go above and beyond sometimes what traditional classrooms look like. Again, fortunately in Anoka Hennepin, with our size and our availability to be able to create a variety of programming across high schools, this works decently for us, and we've had community support with levies, which has also been very beneficial for us, but not all school districts have those types of things available to them. So the point that I want to emphasize as I close and turn over to Mark Deal is that I would think we would want a more consistent set of experiences for our students that really aren't left to, I guess, sort of an ad hoc nature of decision-making happening and or funding available within the school districts. And so I'll leave with that. I'm hoping just to give you a little glimpse of the idea that today's school is a little bit different than what we remember, no matter how long you've been out of school. We are trying to be more relevant with students and bringing them experiences that help them and decide where their pathway is going to be. With that, I'll introduce Mark Deal, who is going to present a little bit about how we also need to leverage data systems in order to be effective.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome, Mr. Deal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for allowing me to share with you today. I am Mark Deal, and I'm the Director of Information and Technology Services for Low Falls Community Schools. 4 years ago, our district implemented Project REAL. REAL stands for Resources to Engage All Learners. It was a technology project that provided an iPad to every student in grades 5 through 12. This past fall, we expanded that project to include every student in grades pre-K through 12. Today, I would like to speak with you about engagement and how we utilize data systems to improve engagement with students, parents, and the community. Access to data is imperative for bringing about change, whether it is for an individual student, a classroom, a school, or a district. Technology allows us the ability to generate and access that data much more efficiently. Real-time data is crucial to helping educators make informed decisions about individual student and classroom learning. When students have individual access to technology, this data can be generated and analyzed very quickly using tools like Google Forms, Socrative, or Kahoot. These tools allow for educators to access students' prior knowledge before beginning a given lesson or unit, determine the level of content understanding during the unit, and then assess student learning at the end of that same lesson or unit. Let me show you an example of the use of Google Forms. On the left side, you will see some questions that are being asked to assess the prior knowledge of sixth grade students in a language arts classroom. The teacher has instant access to the data as soon as the students complete the assessment and can therefore tailor his or her instruction to meet the specific needs of the class. For example, armed with this data, this pre-assessment produced, our teacher can adjust her whole group teaching to what she knows her students already know and where they are weak. In this circumstance, 82% of her students have clearly identified nouns and over 71% clearly identified verbs. She's confident in spending less whole class instruction time on those concepts, thus freeing up time to reteach pronouns, an area in which the students really struggled. Additionally, this data can be a great tool in helping to differentiate to the individual student level. This teacher can determine specifically which students need the additional support to successfully identify nouns and verbs, and which are ready to be stretched to the next level. The real-time data demonstrated here is only available when every student has access to the technology. Utilizing digital assessments to gather immediate feedback has proven to be highly motivating to students. Students like to know right away how they performed. The days of having to wait overnight for assessment results, like a test, are becoming less and less. Additionally, the manner and expediency of feedback is similar to that of the gaming culture. This provides a hook for some students who may not otherwise be engaged by traditional methods. In many districts, The parents, students, teachers, administrators, coaches, and advisors are using technology to access real-time data on student progress. This valuable information allows individuals to make informed decisions about the student. Advisors, coaches, administrators, and teachers can track student progress to determine eligibility, grade point average, attendance, missing work, and determine if students are on track to graduate. Students use the system to track their grades and missing assignments, and parents use the system to track progress, missing assignments, and even what the student is eating. So on the screen behind me, you're seeing that the real-time data that is available on a smartphone app that our district uses called Skyward. Our students track this daily on their iPads as well. And our parents have the ability to access this from their phones, their computers, or their tablet devices at any time. And the information that is in there is real-time and current. So I can go in there as a parent, and this is my daughter's page. I can go in there as a parent and utilize the data system to not only track her progress, but also to communicate with her teachers. The incredible amount of real-time data that parents have access to has changed how parents and teachers communicate. Communication is now happening when it needs to happen and rarely waits for a scheduled date when teachers and parents can meet. Teachers in Little Falls at the secondary level have seen a significant decrease in attendance at parent-teacher conferences. And while some see this decline as an issue, we view the change as a positive and are now looking for ways to find new uses for the time to improve student learning. With this type of real-time data available, there is a level of accountability that has been raised for both educators and students. Educators now have a greater responsibility to keep their grade book up to date. Students now have to stay on top of missing assignments and grades, as access to the information is more readily available. A few years ago, I had a student come into my office, and he asked me this very important question to him. How much money will it cost me to have you turn off this real-time access to my parents? And I asked him, why do you need that? He said, I have missing assignments, and I want to go out with my friends this weekend. I suggested to him that maybe getting those assignments done would make his problem go away. I'm fairly confident that was not the response he wanted to hear. Beyond the real-time data, technology is the conduit being used to increase engagement between the student, parent, and teacher in other ways, whether it be classroom websites, social media, learning management systems, emails, or student information portals. The levels of information available to students and parents and the community are increasing. The increase of information allows our stakeholders to be more informed about the happenings in the classroom, school, and district. Technology is allowing for the opportunity to extend the learning day for students. With increased access to their teachers and collaboration tools, students are finding that getting answers to their questions is much easier, and students are using technology to explore topics of interest that may or not be covered in class. Many students choose to demonstrate this new knowledge through websites, presentations, video, and blog posts. So while technology can be viewed as impersonal, it is in fact allowing for personalized learning to take place. It is through this personalization that the relevance in learning can be found, and through the relevance, increased engagement. And with that, I'd like to invite Josh Swanson back to the table to share about personalized learning in Eden Prairie.
Thank you very much. And welcome back, Mr. Swanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Josh Swanson, for the record, for Eden Prairie. I'm going to share just a few of my experiences while serving in Eden Prairie schools, where each of our K-12 students has access to a digital tool and tremendous connectivity. Guiding this work, though, and at the core is our strategic plan and our board ends policy. Our community demands that each of our students is prepared for a future that we don't know yet, that each of our students is career and college ready, and that we maintain the highest level of expectations for each of our students and for ourselves as we work to eliminate our achievement disparities. Our community expects this to be carried out within a digital culture and environment. As we heard from Mr. Hobart earlier, that need for resiliency, 21st century skills, ability to work in a fluid environment is part of what our community expects for each of our students. And so as you think about our strategic plan and what we want to see, and you'll see evidenced in the slides here, part of our outcomes that we want for each of our students is to be able to know that they've developed these 21st century skills, We've defined them as creativity, communication, collaboration, critical thinking, the ability to problem solve, work in teams, and be able to express ideas to effectively make change. We don't drop, and our community would never let us drop, that level of academic rigor and content knowledge that's built into that as well. But there's a realization that that's not all our students need as we go forward. They need to be information literate. They need to be able to connect through those digital mediums. And they need to be able to understand and learn how to be good, responsible digital citizens at the same time. We also believe that our students need to come out with those global competencies that you see up there, including citizenship. And I heard resiliency several times in the comments this morning. That's so key to helping our students be prepared as they leave our public institutions. This means that through leveraging technology, our students each develop the skills and knowledge necessary to be successful as they leave Eden Prairie schools. We not only expect that they have the necessary content knowledge, but they can also demonstrate proficiency of these 21st century and global competencies. Having appropriate technology is necessary to see this come to life in a digital age. In Eden Prairie, we're really fortunate to have a community that's provided us with the resources to be able to create that conduit of opportunities for our students. That's not the case everywhere. We've been able to provide students with tremendous connectivity and access. As I referenced earlier, each of our students, kindergarten through 12th grade, has a device that's assigned to them that they use and leverage on a daily basis, both at home and at school. We've built out a robust infrastructure and tremendous internet capability to be able to allow those students to be able to connect on a daily basis and to connect with teachers, community, and other resources. We've embraced digital learning and are moving towards a truly personalized learning environment. And that crosses curricular areas. It looks at learning strategies, instructional strategies, and really an integrated approach to what technology looks like. We're not teaching technology. We're helping students learn, and technology is one of those conduits to help that happen. Our teachers and our students use digital data on a daily basis to inform their practice and inform students. So not only do the teachers know how students are doing, our teachers know how students are doing, students know how they're doing. And they get feedback not only from their teachers, but their peers on a regular basis. And we know from research that that's one of those things that's a really high-yield strategy to help students continue to move forward as they set goals and build both those 21st century skills and global competencies. We've done this while acknowledging that technical support and professional development must be provided and resourced appropriately. Technical support is critical to moving this forward. Without it, you end up with a high level of frustration very quickly, and it crosses stakeholder groups from teachers to students to parents. When you're in this kind of digital environment, it has to be dependable. I know we've heard Plan B referenced, but we've worked hard to make sure Plan B just doesn't have to occur inside of our system and inside of our district. The technology just fades away because it just always works. But that takes resourcing it appropriately and building out those enterprise systems that are robust, have redundancy, and that you have expertise on staff who are able to build, design, and make sure that happens, along with building replacement cycles so that you don't end up falling behind or just kind of standing on the treadmill while you watch everybody else go by. Professional development is also absolutely critical. We've provided numerous opportunities for our administrators, our leadership teams, our lead teachers to learn, to create a vision together, to be able to support that. We've been able to support our teachers through coaching. We've invested into ongoing job-embedded professional development and learning opportunities for our teachers that exist both inside of their workday and outside of their workday in both synchronous and asynchronous ways. So we don't necessarily have to have everybody in the same room at the same time to be able to continue to learn and grow and improve what we do. Not only have we been able to work with staff, but we've used resources to spend time with parents to bring them along because we didn't grow up in that environment as we watch our kids go through that system. At the end of the day, we've worked really hard in Eden Prairie Schools to continue to work towards transforming what education looks like in our system. I can't stress enough how important that proper support and professional development are if you're going to manage that change effectively. Not every district has the resources, support, and personnel to make this happen, from technology leaders that you've seen being presented in front today to those technologists who are in classrooms supporting teachers on a daily basis and making those great things happen for students. All of this work is being done to move us toward our mission of inspiring each student every day in Eden Prairie Schools. And we're personalizing learning so it's relevant, rigorous, and prepares our students for the world they will lead. The response from our teachers and our students has been tremendous, as teachers actively facilitate and guide students on a journey of learning. Honestly, we've found things that we never expected as we've gone down that path. I'd like to share a short video that they produced that demonstrates what personalized learning looks like today through our initiative of iLearn at EP and our digital conversion. I'll take a minute so you can hear from them directly as opposed to me.
Could the volume be turned up just a bit more? Thank you.
Speaking of technology needs.
You're too old for technology.
I can't see.
I had the opportunity last week to go into a classroom and watch our kindergarten students coding and looking at thinking about how to creatively think through things and look at that. And it was amazing to watch our kindergarten students doing that and interacting with each other and devices. And the beautiful part is the technology just blends away. We continue to get better and improve as a system, but that opportunity and our success is strongly connected to the technology conduit that we've built in Eden Prairie. We hope the information that we have shared with you today about the current state of technology in Minnesota education has been helpful, and that it will help us move towards closing the opportunity gap that exists within our state. We've provided contact information at the end of our presentation if we can be of future service or provide additional information that you require. I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for providing us the time today to present and for introducing bills that would help us build that conduit that will help us truly become a system of educational excellence that will take our children and state into a great future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Swanson. On behalf of the committee, we commend each of you for the outstanding job and the way you synchronized everything so effectively in one set of slides and with the audio amplification as well. It was exceptionally well done. We're going to open for questions in about 8 to 10 minutes, but first we're going to hear from a few others that had asked to testify, and I'm going to ask Mark Paulson and Mark Garrison from two different school districts to join us. They'll be followed by Cassie Baer from the director of Mobile Citizen. Then we'll open it for questions, and recognizing the tight timeline, we're going to then get a overview with brief testimony at about 10:20 on a few of the files, and again, we'll be revisiting this later in session. Welcome.
Good morning, Chairman Wieger, members of the committee. I have a handout. I'm sorry, it's my first rodeo. Not sure if. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My name is Mark Paulson. I work for School District 622. We serve North St. Paul, Oakdale, and Maplewood. I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to share with you the financial reality facing our district and how it's impacting our ability to serve our students. With the time that I have with you, I'd like to leave you with three points that I hope you'll consider when thinking about funding needs for E-12 institutions. The first point is the degree to which the existing funding structure has led to a substantial inequity in terms of what different districts have to provide their students. Our district borders seven other districts. If we were to get the average in additional per-student funding that our seven neighboring districts get, that would translate into about $6 million a year for us, which would be transformational. We're at the point now where we almost can't afford to accept free money. Think of us as the game show contestant that wins the free car but can't afford the taxes. We recently got a grant from 3M, which is a great partner, for $350,000 to build some STEM labs. And as a district, we're having a very hard time meeting our obligations for those supports around those labs. And the impact of that inequity gets compounded when you look at it in relation to the needs of our students. And that brings me to my second point, which is to dispel the myth of the digital native, which doesn't seem to exist in this room. But out in the community, there's a lot of people that believe that children, young people born today by virtue of being born in the digital revolution, are going to be proficient in the use of technology in all domains, including as a learning tool and a productivity tool, by virtue of the fact that they're very good at using it for social media and entertainment. And we know that that's not true. And what we also know is that young kids in more affluent homes get significantly more guidance in how to use technology as a learning tool and as a productivity tool. So we know that we need to provide students opportunities to develop and practice that skill, to use technology for learning and productivity, or they're not going to develop that. Which brings me to my third point, which is that many districts, in order to provide that opportunity for their students, they have to pass a technology levy to do that. And passing a technology levy is going to be a much heavier lift for some districts than it is for others by virtue of the populations that they're communicating with. If you look at the research, three groups of people typically report not using the Internet on a regular basis. That would be the elderly, those making less than $30,000 a year, and non-native English speakers. And when you look at that in the context of our student population, we've just doubled the number of students that qualify for free and reduced lunch, so we're now over 51%. And our English language learner population has also increased. Now they're over 10% of our student body. So when we're going out to our community to try and convince them that this is an important thing that we want to provide to our students, that message may not necessarily resonate as strongly because that reality may not be reflected in their experience as learners. And so it's a heavier lift for us to convey the significance of having this access for their kids. So moving forward, I hope that when you're thinking about E-12 funding and needs, you remember those three points that some of us are pretty far behind and our students need it the most. And we have communities that are going to be difficult to convince or show the value of that opportunity. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Paulson. Mr. Garrison.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Garrison. I'm the Director of Technology for the White Bear Lake Area Schools. And we are having success leveraging technology to really bring both student and teacher growth. Your support is going to help us to build on the success that we've already established and to really help spread that around the state. Our goal in White Bear is to provide technology that's consistent and comprehensive and that empowers staff and students to make learning decisions based on what's best for learning rather than on availability and access. We want a teacher to be able to take advantage of that teachable moment without having to say, I can't get into the computer lab until next Thursday. And we never want a student to be in a position where he goes home and can't participate in a group project because he doesn't have internet access. Therefore, we've been careful stewards of our capital projects levy, which we were fortunate to actually pass an increase in 2013, thanks in large part to the support of legislators, city leaders, boards, business groups, and our great community. We're using those funds to improve our network infrastructure, to launch a one-to-one, and really to try to provide as much technology as we can to all White Bear learners. Our work has drawn national attention. And indeed, in our engagement puts us at about the 90th percentile when you look at Google Apps for Education schools nationally. So we know that technology is being used and being used well to drive substantive change that's helping our students communicate, collaborate, think critically, and express their creativity every single day. Now, in White Bear, we serve both Ramsey and Washington counties. And in keeping with Margaret Anderson Kelleher's broadband map, when we survey our students, they report that about 95% of them have internet access at home. But when we dig deeper and we talk to them about what that means, we find that that might mean that they have one shared computer that their whole family uses. And if you're a high school senior who goes home at the end of the day and you're sharing one computer with your four siblings and your time on the computer is 20 minutes, our students report that's about enough time to log in, get their homework downloaded, and then log back off. But to actually engage in that work is a real challenge for them. We want to make sure that we're opening up opportunities for all of our students to succeed. We've seen the biggest impact when all of our students have internet access at home and at school, an internet-ready device in their hands, and when their teachers have really purposeful professional development that helps them learn how to use that technology. With your support and a consistent funding stream for technology this session, we can help to realize that vision. When this happens, we see third graders like rushing home at night to log on to Google Apps to join their collaborative writing group. We have other third graders that are thriving because of individualized math instruction. We have over 50 middle school students that are serving their peers and teachers as student support technicians. And they're also repurposing computers to hand out to our families in need. We have high school students that are presenting at the U of M about their success replacing like crazy expensive spectrometers with a simple iPhone app to really do some high-level investigation. We have teachers, staff, and leadership engaging in summer technology camps, in before and after school meetups. And this year, 1 in 10 of our teachers will have participated in a year-long graduate-level course that surrounds technology and leadership. These changes are how we close the opportunity gap. These changes are how we innovate. These changes are how we realize all the great ideas that have been thrown out here today in this session. And these ideas are how we empower every student in our system to learn. To educate the world's best workforce, one that excels globally, we need to broaden our current success and put technology in the hands of every student in our district. With your support, we can make that happen. And we can bring that to every student in the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Garrison and Mr. Paulson. And we're going to open it up for questions in just a few minutes. Next, we'll hear from Cassie Bear. Welcome.
Hi. My name is Cassie Bear, and I'm the Managing Director for Mobile Citizen. Mobile Citizen is an initiative of Vocal, which is 5 nonprofit organizations committed to bringing technology to the education and nonprofit communities for over 25 years. We are based in Colorado, but work nationally to ensure social equity through access, and specifically do a lot of work in the Minnesota area with multiple school districts and nonprofits such as PCs for People. We're a social enterprise venture, and we provide low-cost mobile internet to schools through devices such as this, as well as nonprofits and social welfare agencies, by either selling directly to those organizations for them to use internally in program activities, or to resell to families that are in need. And that usually involves low-income families, as you can imagine. This is really in response to the fact that 62 million Americans don't have access to the internet. It's kind of hard to believe in a day and age like this, especially when you look around and see everybody on their iPads and their computers. In Minnesota, Mobile Citizen brings wireless internet services to a dozen school districts for students and their employees. We talked with a couple folks that we service in preparation for today, and the ones that really stood out to me were the ones that came in from the Edina school system. I spoke with Gabriel Moreno, who's the academic support supervisor and AVID site coordinator. He told me that recently EPS, like many school districts, has emphasized the use of technology by implementing a one-to-one student-to-computer device ratio. They believe this affords students and staff real-life problem-solving surrounding 21st century skills. We've been supportive of this endeavor by bridging the connectivity gap for them because they were seeing a high need with all of their students. One of the challenges within the Edina School District is that they chose to use devices that use the cloud for data storage and basic applications for things like word processing. In other words, in order to access anything in the school that was being put out for staff or students, you had to be able to get online. And this presented a problem. How does a student use a device that relies on the cloud for data storage when the student is only guaranteed to connect to the cloud at school. It's an interesting situation. With individual mobile broadband devices, they're able to equip students with the resources they need to connect to a variety of online learning materials, presentations, notes, projects, and email. Before they distributed personal Wi-Fi devices, they said that students either spent lots of free time at the library, which, by the way, approximately 50% of libraries in the U.S. don't have sufficient internet access to support their patrons, so you can imagine what kind of challenges that presents, or they spent lots of time in other places trying to access Wi-Fi in order just to get their basic work done. By partnering with Mobile Citizen, they have complete internet coverage in their school, so both in the school and then also after school. This coverage allows students to do work from home, and parents no longer worry about where their students are after the school hours or how to get them there while maintaining all the other things that you have to do after work. Mobile Citizen works to provide mobile broadband access to over 10,000 low-income families in the state of Minnesota. With mobile broadband, people are empowered to access school services, job sites, and information resources online from school, home, and work. The digital divide is a national issue, but it's also a local issue as well. Connected technology, which is that umbrella term for using computers, tablets, and cell phones connected via the internet to extract or share knowledge, is essential for helping students connect with resources and expand their critical thinking, their communication, and their collaboration skills, all things that are going to serve them well later in life. In addition, the internet has opened up a new pathway for millions to access a variety of educational opportunities, employment, and social networking, just to name a few things. When Mobile Citizen launched, they found that they had developed a business that a lot of people could find, as they developed their business, they could find that resources to access computers and training, which also can be a struggle, but those were often there if people poked around and really looked for it. But the cost of obtaining and maintaining internet services was prohibitive. Imagine being a family of four living off less than $30,000 a year and trying to pay $40 or more a month for internet services. It's not always going to be your priority. One of our local reseller partners shared with us a study that showed that households with incomes below $25,000 are half as likely to own a computer compared to households with incomes above $50,000. Adults in these families are less likely to learn the basic computer skills, and the children in there are unable to complete their homework or take advantage of the online learning tools that are often available to their classmates. They launched a PC for Kids initiative a few years ago when they found out that Minneapolis school children with a home PC were sent home with math software, but those without a PC were sent home with flashcards. This has evolved over time, obviously, but one of the things that stood out to them was that the main issue at this point was less about the computers, although that's still a need, and more about the internet connectivity. So they partnered with Mobile Citizen to try and make a difference around that. Although the internet is an open system for users, it is not free to access. Low-income families, rural communities, and small organizations are the hardest hit with this. When this happens, information and learning opportunities are bypassing people who sometimes are in the most need of these services, jobs, or education. Usually it's those who are in the greatest need that are missing out when it comes to internet access. I also spoke with Heidi Howard, who also works with Gabriel. She actually had quite a bit to say, and she was very passionate about everything that she talked to me about. She distributes computer equipment in her high school, but quickly identified that only they were only giving students half of what they needed. So they were giving them the equipment, but not the internet access. So when they tapped into Mobile Citizen's offers, they found that it really made a difference in the quality of education that was going on with their students. She has students that are obviously receiving free and reduced lunch, but she also has students that are just above the cutoff for that. And she said those families are often the ones that struggle a little bit more to be able to provide that internet access because they don't have some of the additional support that the others do. She gave me a specific story about a student that had come in the day before who needed internet access immediately. She was already behind in her classes and was desperate to get something done. And she had two choices to give her. She had one of these devices left to be able to take home and work on things, or she could apply for another program that requires a stringent amount of data to be able to apply and receive internet access. And the student, of course, immediately opted to take this home because it was something she could do immediately and quickly because she was already so concerned about where she sat with her grades. I talked to her a little bit more, Heidi that is, about her thoughts on education and technology. And she said education has pushed to technology. She firmly believes that. And she sees a need to just do to do more than just the basics of keeping up with technology, which is already a struggle to do. My favorite quote from her on this topic was that a lack of technology puts a population at risk for not receiving free education. I thought that was extremely powerful. It's just not right, she said. Education in schools is about being best prepared with technology to make it equitable for everyone. To do that, you have to have internet. Imagine 8 hours a day needing something and not having it. Would you be able to learn equally? I'm guessing not. So one of the things that we've done over the last 4 months that I've been at Mobile Citizen is, you know, we've talked a lot with folks about what they need and why they do it and how they do it. And I have to tell you, the comments that came in from the Edina school system were probably some of the most powerful that I've heard. They really believe that they are nowhere close to where they need to be in order to provide students the services they need to access media-rich content and after-school educational opportunities. Mobile Citizen has a national footprint, but we work with modest resources. We are the first 4G service provider in the U.S. to offer broadband service exclusively to nonprofit organizations and schools at a remarkably low rate. Honestly, our service is $10 a month. We basically operate as a nonprofit to get this in the hands of the people that need it. Due to the support we have received from Vocal, Mobile Citizen is a pioneer in the field of bridging the digital divide. The last 6 years, we have demonstrated success, but we have also seen more and more need. No single organization can fight an issue this significant alone. Our resources derive from the United States FCC wireless licensees granted to us that require us to specifically serve schools on a not-for-profit basis. We currently work with Sprint to execute our programs throughout the U.S. and also in Minnesota. But we feel like there's more that could be done. And we would like to imagine what we could do in the state of Minnesota if organizations such as Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, and other partners collaborated on the issue of internet access for students. It could make a lifetime of difference. So we hope that moving forward, public policy in Minnesota can help us convince other broadband providers to match our efforts with Sprint and our public service mission.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bear. We're going to open it up for questions for about 5 minutes or so. Again, we're going to revisit this topic later during session. Senator Kiffmeyer. And whoever you'd like to direct a question to, I believe most of our testifiers are here.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mark Hurlburt is a specific question that I would like to start out with, Mark, but anybody is welcome to answer that. Probably what struck me is a lot of information about technology. I think we all would agree. I don't think that's a hard thing to do. It's a matter of the paying for it and working that through. But what was most interesting to me, which I've heard a lot from my school district and my business people, that the greater issue are the soft skills. Could you please address that issue of soft skills and how you think some solutions might be included there? Because I have not heard that from anybody else other than you, and that's what my district talks about a lot.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for the question.
For the tape, state your name again.
Mark Hurlburt.
Could you move your microphone up a bit?
Thanks.
So part of what we think specifically, you know, our focus is on engineering, on software engineering as a discipline and looking at how we can help people kind of be prepared for work in that industry. And a big part of it comes down to engineers in general and software engineers in particular learn by doing. And in the context of the industry, it's not, you know, people have this picture in their head of software engineers as people who kind of are in a basement and they're, you know, working on a kind of mad genius kind of work, and that's simply not the reality of the industry any longer. You know, the nerdery, the company that I worked for many years is 500 people, 300 of which are technical staff that work together in teams from 3 to 20 people on projects. And so the collaboration and the importance of that and those skills for being able to communicate effectively, to take and receive feedback and criticism, to be able to coordinate efforts are very, very important for being able to actually get work done. One of the things that we feel is a contributor to that, and one way that schools can improve that is trying to bring more project work and sometimes less directed project work into the curriculum. I volunteer in the Bloomington Public School Systems as a mentor for their coding club. They have an after school coding club because I don't believe they have coding as part of their normal curriculum. And that's one of the things that we really work with students on in that context, is trying to get them to be thinking creatively, working as a group to try and achieve an objective, and that really builds a lot of those skills. You can see it at work in those environments. I don't know if that answers your question.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Kent, and she'll be followed by Senator Johnson, then we're going to go to four of the bills. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the interest of time, this can be more just of a sort of an FYI comment, but if Ms. Baer or any of the IT folks from our wonderful school districts would want to address this point, I would certainly welcome that feedback. As a reminder, last year we created a new legislative commission on data practices, and I, along with Senator Peterson, serve on that commission. And education data is a big area of concern. We have a lot of private data about our students out there, and we need to make sure that we are providing security for that information. And an example that Ms. Baer gave, I thought, was a good one. When she was speaking, I think it was of Edina schools using the cloud for a lot of schoolwork. So if a student perhaps, we tell our kids, write what you know. Well, if a student perhaps writes an essay of a very personal nature and that ends up on the cloud, we need to make sure that our school districts have the information, the training, and the resources to make sure that they are keeping that kind of information protected according to the laws that already exist and that we may need to make sure are in place. So it is a complicated issue. A lot of people sort of lose track sometimes that this stuff is out there and accessible. And I just want us all to keep that in the back of our mind. This technology is hugely important. Everything we're talking about is, but it doesn't come without some risks that we need to be sensitive to and staying alert to and making sure that our districts and the department have the resources to handle it responsibly.
Thank you. And brief reaction, Mr. Verdine.
If I could respond, and actually, I'm Joel Verdine, Anoka Hennepin. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could respond to this, it is. I would absolutely agree. It is a field that's changing fairly quickly, and we, in schools, oftentimes don't necessarily get very consistent legal guidance on these issues. And so, I know for our school district, and we've shared with a number a series of contractual issues that need to be worked through, and anytime that we accept a service where we are moving data between our internal networks and whatever we're using externally, we have to make sure that our privacy policies and the contract with the company holds those to the same standards that we accept here as the state of Minnesota. But I would say in all districts, most districts could use better information to help them work through some of that. So I'm agreeing with you, and I believe it is an issue of significance.
Thank you.
And we have one final question, Senator Johnson, and it's being directed to you.
I'd like to speak to you, Mr. Verdine.
Excuse me, Senator Pratt?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, could I just ask for a point of order real quick?
Yes.
You know, this is a very important topic, and we've got a lot of testifiers here. I'm wondering if the chair would entertain pushing off the bill reviews and allow us more time to ask some questions. It just seems like we've had a lot of testimony. There's a lot of information here. I've got some questions, and I just don't feel like we've got enough time to do it. So I'm sorry to interrupt, Senator Johnson, but
okay.
I'm wondering if we can maybe allow more time for questions and do the bill reviews at another meeting.
Senator Pratt, yeah, that's fine. We're going to be hearing this again, and you know, we could actually spend a day going through all of the ramifications here. The bills are listed. They're for information, they were just going to be laid over. We can do that in the future, recognizing the limited amount of time. But so we'll go to Senator Johnson to follow up, and then we'll take your question.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Verdun, my question is, have you ever done or could you do a cost-benefit analysis of how much it costs if you don't do this? In your testimony, you talked about dealing with the students with autism and English learning issues, and I wrote this down. You wrote that it's a no-brainer to do. Do you find it would be more costly to not do it than it would be to do it? Have you ever done an analysis? And you can answer me later if you choose to.
In terms of doing strictly an analysis would actually be fairly challenging in terms of monetary loss of not doing that. I can say that I probably would be run out of town on a rail by my school district for not allowing our teachers to have tools that allow them to effectively work with kids. And in the case of the student populations that I was talking about, the parents, as I had mentioned, our parents are very passionate about their children, and they would not easily accept that we would shortchange their education by not providing certain tools for their kids to do very well in school. to the question, I know you'd asked about a specific cost-benefit analysis. Very, very difficult on that topic of what does it cost not to do something. I always like to think it's in our best interest always to have good handoffs with kids, that when they interact between us and parents, that we have a good, seamless environment. The cost of not doing so is disengagement from school, potential dropouts. When you learn that, for the most part, students drop out of school not because they're not doing well, it's because they're not engaged with somebody or appropriately within the school system. So those are some of the costs, but they're hard to put a financial marker on. I think most of us could agree that we don't want to see kids who are disengaged from school.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Pratt.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, this has been a really broad discussion in that we've talked about access and availability of broadband, but then also talking about access to devices. And I was wondering if Ms. Kelleher would have time for a couple of questions. I'm kind of interested, as we talked about internet availability, we were talking about residential as well as public. How many schools, or what percentage of schools and public buildings are not covered by internet access today in those underserved areas?
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, I referenced in the testimony that we're actually working on that information with the Office of Broadband, and the director of the Office of Broadband was in here for a little bit but had to go off to another mm-hmm. meeting. So I don't know if anyone else in the room would have even a good guess. This is one of the things. Would you like to come up to the table? You know, we have a good sense of libraries in the mm-hmm. state, I believe.
And so, I'm sorry, Ms. Kelleher.
Yeah,
I'm having to take a call. So
it's totally fine. It's all right.
Good morning. I'm Mary Messicomer. I'm the president of the Information and Technology Educators of Minnesota. I'm also Minnesota's E-rate coordinator for the state of Minnesota. So I work a lot with school districts on broadband access issues and telecommunications planning. And what I can tell you is there's most of our schools at this point are fairly in decent shape in terms of broadband access, particularly for those who are in a telecommunications region. We have about 10 of those in the state. About 80% of our school districts are members of one of those regions. And those regions work to aggregate bandwidth and cooperatively purchase bandwidth. And a lot of the service providers that those regions work with have seen the economic benefit to extend fiber and broadband out to even some of the more remoter areas in the state, as long as there are schools involved. When it comes to the speed and so forth, districts are still very cost conscious, using broadband very judiciously. You saw a lot of really great examples of what they're doing today, but we are seeing exponential increases in the amount of broadband that they need, in some cases doubling in the course of just over a year. So providers are working with schools to provide through the E-rate program and through our state telecommunications internet access program to provide that broadband access to schools. So they have a lot of shared bandwidth out there. Are they anywhere near what some of the experts say the projected speed should be? Probably not, but they are getting access to what they can afford and what they can use at this current time.
Thank you. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So our schools are wired and maybe not utilizing the capacity as much as they should.
Yes, and let me clarify that. When we talk about conduit access into the schools from the internet, again, they're sharing that across different regional bodies. They're using it very judiciously. Oftentimes, they are using traffic control on their networks to make sure that the purposes are really directed at teaching and learning, so they are choking back some things. When they are doing statewide testing, for example, there are scenarios where the districts will ratchet everything back and only allow that testing to take place. So it's by no means overflowing, you know, or completely out there, but it's certainly at a point where schools are able to do a lot of great things with teaching and learning. But it there is definitely a need for more. The other point I would make is that's the conduit access to the internet. The other thing schools are having to do is their internal networks, and that is at this point almost entirely a local cost because they have to put in wireless networks because a lot of them are moving to the one-to-one initiatives, having kids bring in their own devices, and they are having to expand those wireless networks internally to also take advantage of that external bandwidth.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you. So maybe I misinterpreted some of the testimony. I thought we were talking about wiring schools, but what we're really talking about is the infrastructure to operate the broadband, or are we really still talking about, in a sense, laying cable?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, I think that if I'm understanding your question correctly, and this is a question we often get, we are in many cases still talking about an effort to wire. Now, to schools, I would say that there is often some wire running to the school, and that's what that's what you're hearing about. That I heard. What I heard is I heard that 80% of school districts are part of a consortium that allow them to get some service at a discounted rate. So we need to understand the 20% that aren't part of that and what that means for their rates of subscription and whether anyone is unserved in that 20%. I think that's what I heard there. And of that 20%, is somebody not connected then? When we're talking about households, we're definitely still talking about wiring. And even when we talk about using the wireless mechanism to fill gaps across the state, the technology is such that you are talking about the backhaul that needs to be wired to a tower to be able to send that signal across the area to have a good enough, strong enough signal. And that's often misunderstood. Now, the challenge, of course, with wireless today is there was a time that you can all remember about 10 years ago where there was unlimited wireless plans. And that changed, and therefore most plans today that if you sign up or you need to do a change, you have a data-capped plan. And these students who would come home today and want to watch a video or any of those things will blow their parents' video plan. In fact, I was dealing with that earlier this morning with my college student down in St. Peter. I don't know what he was doing, but I'm pretty sure that it was not just downloading email, okay? Because he's going to blow one of the plans this month. And so I think that that is one of the concerns here is that the broadband task force is agnostic on whether what type of wired connection it needs to be or what even if it needs to be a wired connection. But we do know a wired connection provides a level of reliability and usually a level of cost consciousness for the consumer entity that is good.
Thank you. Any further questions or comments?
There was an addition to that.
Sorry. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, I'm Mark Johnson, East Central, or ECMAC. We are one of the cooperatives that Mary was talking about. And just, you know, we're dealing with layers here, so I try to answer something that I heard you say in your comment or your question. It is about the biggest concern that we have is that access for students outside of the school building. Inside the school buildings, we are well wired. We have infrastructure costs that Mary talked about. We have the cost of getting that internet to the school building. We're able to do that, but of course the schools incur that cost. It's then the decisions that they make because they say this is important, and so we spend money on doing this, and we spend money on getting the internet access here, we spend money on the devices and so on. And then we send our kids home, and they don't always have that. So that's the real, you know, the real crux of that part of the problem. In the schools, they're doing everything they can with the technology. They're using all the bandwidth that they have available. They're doing some of the things that you saw us do. It's our ability to move that away to and make it anytime, anywhere learning for the students that causes you know some of the problem. And then the decisions that we make, because we think that's important, because we think 21st century skills are important to be incorporating into what we're doing in the schools, sometimes we don't do other things because we're using the money to do, you know, to pay for the bandwidth and to pay for the access. So sometimes that poses a bit of an issue too. So I just wanted to make that point. Maybe that helped with what you were wondering about.
Excuse me, Senator Pratt, we're out of time.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I want to thank everyone for their outstanding testimony.
Thank you.
You did a great job in putting this together. We will be readdressing this either the last week of January or early February for a hearing. The Senate files reference, they're posted. I wanted you to know, too, I have an A1 amendment on the telecommunications aid and regional library, and that'll be posted, an A1 amendment that puts an appropriation. Ms. Keefe was here to testify on that. There'll be other ideas forthcoming as well. And a reminder, our next meeting will be tomorrow, and we're going to be discussing early learning. And on Thursday, we'll focus on facilities, and we have a couple of bills that are set to be heard on that. Happy birthday, Senator Housley, and there be no further business. We adjourn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.